Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Pam Carlin, the Kenneth and Harl Montgomery Professor of Public Interest Law at Stanford and co-director of the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic. I'll be moderating tonight's program. Tonight's program is part of a series of programs underwritten by the Geschke family, which examine the United States Constitution in the 21st century. The Commonwealth Club's series on the United States Constitution in the 21st century examines the balance between safety, security, and public order on the one hand, and the protection of civil liberties and the integrity of the Constitution on the other. To that end, it's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, David Boies, chairman of the law firm of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, LLP. If in real estate it's true that it's location, 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 then I guess tonight it's timing, timing, timing. There are a number of fictional characters, Woody Allen Zelig and Winston Guest's Forrest Gump come to mind, who turn up at every important event of their times. David Boies, though, is the real deal. In virtually every important legal issue of the past 40 years, Mr. Boies has played a pivotal role. Whether it was defending CBS in a path-breaking libel case, serving as special trial counsel for the United States in its antitrust suit against Microsoft, or representing Vice President Al Gore in Bush against Gore, the role that led to his being played by Ed Begley in the movie Recount, David Boies has been there. His latest high-profile case, Perry against Schwarzenegger, was decided yesterday by Judge Vaughn Walker of the Northern District of California, and it was a sweeping victory. In his 136-page ruling, Judge Walker held that California's ban on marriages between partners of the same sex violates the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses of the 14th Amendment. There's an old Korean saying that one should never let one's skill exceed one's virtue. As someone who's followed the Perry proceedings with great professional and personal interest, I should say that David Boies and his colleagues, both on the plaintiff's team and for the plaintiff interveners, have provided us with a model of the marriage of a passion for a cause and superb technical lawyering. Please welcome David Boies.
Thank you. And thank all of you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. It's particularly a pleasure to be here after yesterday. Yesterday, the system worked. I've been practicing law for more than 40 years. And there are times that the system works and the times the system doesn't work. When the system doesn't work, it's painful. And it's particularly painful for those of us who have devoted their lives to the justice system and who fundamentally believe in the justice system. But when the justice system actually does work for America, it is a great achievement and it's a great feeling. This country was founded not based on a race or an ethnicity, not based on color or language. It was founded based on a culture. And that culture is a culture of equality. When it was founded, that culture of equality existed only for a small fraction of the citizens of this nation. Gradually, over time, we have been expanding that cultural, expanding that scope of the people who have the ability to benefit from that culture of equality. We've seen it in areas of race, we've seen it in areas of gender. We have a long, long way to go in this country in many areas where discrimination continues. But there's only one area in this country in which we have discrimination not based on individual prejudice and bias, but on a official, state-sponsored, state-enforced discrimination against a group of our fellow citizens. And that is in the area of gay and lesbian rights. It is only in that area that the state still stands in and does what it did for so many years in the area of race, so many years in the area of gender, and actually affirmatively, in a state-sponsored way, discriminates against our fellow citizens. And the great thing about what happened yesterday is I think we took an enormous step, not the last step, not even the next to last step, but an important first step in eliminating this last bastion of official state-sponsored discrimination in this country. And by doing that, we've moved ourselves much closer to the ideal that this country was founded on. And we've done it through the courts. It's great when you can make progress towards equality at the ballot box or through the legislature. And we've done that, too, in various areas. But fundamentally, we cannot allow individual rights to be determined by a vote of any majority, no matter how large. If you do, you don't need a constitution. The whole point of a constitution is to say there are certain rights that the majority does not have the right to take away from a minority, and that we're not going to put, as the Supreme Court said in 1933, we're not going to put fundamental rights up to a vote. Because the decision when this nation was founded was that we wanted a democracy with majority rule, but we wanted that consistent with the protection of certain fundamental rights for everyone, majority and minority alike. And that balance in the Constitution is the balance that I think distinguishes the nation that we founded and has been emulated so many places elsewhere, sometimes even ahead of us, unfortunately, but has been emulated so many times elsewhere since. It is a point of encouragement, but also a point of embarrassment, that we have been left behind in the march to equality that we started. When Mexico and Argentina, Spain and South Africa are ahead of us in providing equal rights to our citizens, there's something fundamentally wrong. And what's fundamentally wrong is that we have always, as a nation, been able to discriminate only by diminishing the people that we discriminate against. The concept of equality is baked into the American soul. We believe in it. Everyone believes in it. Except the problem has always been that we've been prepared to say, often about very large groups, increasingly about fewer and fewer groups, well, they're not really equal. They're not really like us. They don't really deserve all of the benefits that we would fight and die to preserve for ourselves and for the people that we include within our circle. And so we were able to say, African Americans don't really deserve equal rights. Asian Americans don't really deserve equal rights. Women don't really deserve equal rights. Gays and lesbians don't really deserve equal rights because they really aren't quite equal. They're not really the same. And I think that what has happened is that gradually we are coming to understand that all people, in the words of our Declaration of Independence, are created equal. That all people have the same inalienable rights, and that our Constitution is designed to protect that. As a very young lawyer in the middle 1960s, I had both the privilege and the awful experience of litigating civil rights cases in Mississippi, where you found your opponents were not merely the people on the other side, not merely even the jury, but also the judges. We've come a long way since then in a lot of areas. And one of the things that I take great pride in is the extent to which we have been able as a country to lead the progress towards equality through the judicial system. The judges in the South, many of them conservative Democrats, many of them Republicans, who stood out in the civil rights battle, were people who were prepared to follow the dictates of the law, even at extreme cost to themselves, cost in reputation, cost in relationships in the community, even cost in terms of their physical danger. Frank Johnson had guards around his house the entire period of time he served as a federal judge after he made the first decision that he made on civil rights. And these people were prepared to follow the law and follow the dictates of the Constitution. And it's through that process that we have made enormous progress, and it is through that process that we had the decision that we had yesterday, and that I believe we will one day see the courts declare that all Americans deserve equal rights. We said at the beginning of the trial that we would prove three things. We said we would prove that marriage was a fundamental right. We said we would prove that depriving gay and lesbian citizens of the right to marry seriously harmed them and seriously harmed the children that they were raising. And we said that we were going to prove that permitting gay and lesbian citizens marrying could not in any way harm any other member of society, could not undermine heterosexual marriage, could not undermine the institution of marriage. And we proved every one of those things. And in the opinion that the judge issued yesterday, he lays to rest in a thorough, thoughtful, careful way every one of the arguments that people have ever put up to justify discrimination against gays and lesbians. The idea that marriage was a fundamental right was actually not that hard to prove, because the Supreme Court has said it a number of times. It said it with respect to people who were child support scoff laws. It said it about people who were imprisoned. Missouri had a law that said felons who are imprisoned can't get married because they can't have any contact with their spouses. They can't fulfill the traditional roles of marriage, the state of Missouri said, and therefore there's no point in giving them a marriage license. United States Supreme Court said no. They said marriage is such a fundamental personal right, a right of personal liberty, of personal relationships. It's not a question of physical contact. It's not a question of procreation. It's a question of liberty and the right of association and the pursuit of happiness. And they said you can't take this away even from people who have committed felonies and are in prison for the rest of their lives. Wisconsin had a law that said if you've abused one marriage, you don't get a second chance, at least until you've cleaned up what you owe from the first. And so that people who just disregarded their child support obligations didn't get a marriage license. United States Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Marriage is such a fundamental right that everybody is entitled, even people who have abused that right in the past, even people who owe the state money, even people who have defaulted on their obligations to previous wives and children, they have the right to get married because marriage is such a fundamental right. It is the most important individual right, the Supreme Court says. And yet, you still have people who are prepared to argue that marriage is not a fundamental right for some people. And so we said, well, let's look at how that right is applied. First, is there any harm that comes from depriving gay and lesbian citizens of the right to marry. After all, they've got domestic partnerships. Why do they need the right to marry? Well, first of all, we brought in lots of experts who testified to something that was pretty obvious. That is, in a sense, what lawyers do. We bring in people to testify about things that everybody else knows. But we brought in experts from all over the world that testified about the importance of marriage and the stability that it brings to people's lives and the social acceptance that it brings. And we brought in people that testified about the adverse effects that occur with children who are brought up in households where their parents can't marry. So that you have not only the harm to gay and lesbian couples, but you've got the harm to their children. And one of the things that was interesting is that on cross-examination, even the witnesses that the defendants chose, prepared, and brought into court ended up admitting that depriving gay and lesbian citizens of the right to marry seriously harmed them and seriously harmed their children. And yesterday, the court found that as a fact. And we also brought in experts to prove the third point, which is that there isn't any basis to believe that allowing gay and lesbian marriage is any way going to hurt heterosexual marriage. Now, again, this is one of those things that you think with common sense you ought not to need experts to tell you. The idea that, you know, young straight boy and girl in love are going to decide, oh, we don't want to get married because our gay neighbors are getting married. Or a happily married couple is going to say, well, I just heard that our lesbian friends down the block are going to get married. That means we ought to get divorced. There isn't a lot of logic to that argument. But in court, you can't just always rely on logic. So we brought in experts who testified about that and testified about the experience in which you have countries, states, that for a number of years now have permitted gay and lesbian marriages and no adverse effect. In fact, to the extent there's any effect at all, it's affected increasing the stability of relationships, something that the people who advocate so-called family values say they're in favor of. What we ended up doing, however, is not just proving this through our witnesses. Cross-examination is a wonderful thing. It's easy to go around and give speeches. It's easy to go around and make pronouncements. It's even easy to answer a question or two if there's no follow-up. But to get up on the witness stand under oath and have to answer question after question after question is a powerful crucible for truth. And the final analysis, even the defendant's own chosen experts admitted that they had no evidence, none, that allowing gay and lesbian marriage could in any way harm heterosexual marriage or the institution of marriage. And yesterday, the court found that as a fact. And you're going to hear a lot of attacks, not on the opinion that this judge wrote, but on the judge, on the judicial system, on so-called activist judges. Somehow activist judges are judges who do things that you don't like. I remember thinking that the 5-member majority in Bush v. Gore were pretty activist judges. But what you're not going to hear is you're not going to hear people saying, this is what the judge said, I disagree with it, and here's why. And I ask you that if you hear friends, neighbors, colleagues, coworkers, criticizing that opinion. Ask them what's in the opinion that they disagree with. Ask them, what did the judge say that you think is wrong? And why do you think it's wrong? What do you have to say to the contrary? What evidence do you have? What facts do you rely on? Because if we can simply move this debate out of the realm of emotion and bias and prejudice and into the realm of dialogue and logic and evidence, there is not another side. People are always asking me, could you take the other side of this case? Could you take the other side of that case? Usually the answer is actually yes. A lot of the cases that I do are cases in which there are good arguments on both sides. But there are some cases in which there simply is not another side. And this is one of those cases. There is not, I suggest to you, something to balance here. This isn't balancing safety and order against individual liberty. This isn't balancing one set of facts against another set of facts. This isn't balancing benefits to one group against harm to another group. This is a situation in which people are being harmed, seriously harmed, daily harmed by this discrimination. And nobody is benefiting except people who want to keep some people separated out, discriminated against, classified as not equal. I would never say that people who have firmly held religious beliefs that there should not be marriage except between a man and a woman are wrong. In this country, under the First Amendment, they are entitled to that point of view. But also under the First Amendment, they are not entitled to impose that view on other people. The First Amendment has two parts. It has a free exercise part that says Congress can make no law, that includes no state can make any law, that prohibits the free exercise of religion. But the second part is it says no state can establish a religion. No state can favor one religion or one religious belief over others. No state can say, because a number of our citizens believe for religious grounds that marriage should be between a man and a woman, that's what we're going to legislate. Religion does not have a place in American legislation. And that's been true since the First Amendment of the Constitution was passed. And so there simply is not a legitimate argument in favor of continuing this discrimination. The other side doesn't have any precedent, doesn't have any facts, doesn't really have any experts. They've got a bumper sticker. I mean, the bumper sticker says marriage is between a man and a woman. That's not the answer. That's the question. And when you look at the judge's opinion yesterday, you will see a resounding, clear, well-supported answer to that question, which says this country has moved away from inequality. It used to be African Americans couldn't even marry each other under slavery. Then it was African Americans and whites can't marry them. Now, it's that gays and lesbians can't marry. All of those restrictions are vestiges of the inequality and discrimination of the past. And yesterday we took a really big step in moving past that as a country. One of the things that I asked their expert witness, who was their chief expert witness, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Blankenhorn, was whether he believed in the American culture of equality. the ideal of equality? And he said he did. And I said, isn't it inconsistent with that to say that gays and lesbians can't get married? And interestingly, he agreed with that. And I asked him whether it wasn't true that America would, by the criteria that we judged, be more American the day we permitted gay and lesbian marriage than it was the day before. And much, I think, to the surprise of some of the people on both sides, he agreed it would. And that's because when you're up on the witness stand, eventually there's no place to hide. And when you can't hide, discrimination falls. Discrimination, bias, and prejudice can survive in the darkness. It can survive unchallenged, but it can't survive in the marketplace of ideas. And it can't survive when it has to face that kind of cross-examination. This was a great day yesterday. It's a great day for our plaintiffs, four of the greatest people you'll ever meet. It was a great day for other gay and lesbian couples who want to get married and for their children. It was a great day for all Americans. All Americans who have or may be threatened with discrimination, but all of us, because we're all diminished when we have that kind of discrimination in this country. But this day really belonged in a lot of ways, not to Ted Olson and myself, who really came along kind of late in the game. It belonged to the people who have fought this battle. For a very long time, at enormous cost, sometimes the cost of their lives. This result is for them more than anybody else. Thank you very much.
Thanks to David Boies, chairman of the law firm of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, for his comments this evening. I'm Pam Carlin, the Kenneth and Harl Montgomery Professor of Public Interest Law and co-director of the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic at Stanford. And Mr. Boies, we have a number of questions. I think we actually have more questions than people in the audience. This is that voting more than once thing, again, causing
like
you a problem.
Like Chicago.
And so what I've done is I've grouped a number of the questions together by topic, and I think we can think of them as the before, during, and after questions. So I'll start with the before questions, and I think you alluded a little bit to this at the end of your talk, which is there has been a long ongoing civil rights movement for the LGBT community, right. And this case came in rather late at the end of the game, and there was some skepticism about the case at the beginning, and there may well be some skepticism now, given the prospects down the road. And so I wondered if you might comment a little bit on how you thought about the case. What was the worst case scenario that you thought about, and what led you to go forward in light of that?
I think the worst case scenario is that you go to court and not only do you lose, but you lose with an opinion that is filled with anti-gay, anti-lesbian rhetoric, because there is a chance that that kind of opinion could not only not give you this avenue of rights, but it could actually be used against the civil rights movement in other areas. And we thought about that, as a possibility. We believe that this was a case, the time was right to bring. We believe that we could win this case. But we also recognize that, as in any case like this, you can lose it. But we concluded that if we lost it, we would not lose it based on the kind of gay bashing that has sometimes occurred, even in judicial opinions, because we were convinced that the country and the courts had moved beyond that. And if all we did was lose, you lose a lot of battles along the way, and we would still have another day in court, and we would still have open to us all the other avenues of, for example, pursuing cases under state court laws, which is the way that the first right was established here in California. It was under the state constitution, not under the federal constitution. The reason that Proposition 8 could void that was because it was a constitutional amendment to the state constitution. But California can't, by itself, amend the federal constitution. And so when we lost the legislative battle, the initiative battle, to amend the state constitution, we could still bring a case under the federal constitution. And even if we lost that, other states could still fight those battles and fight legislative battles, fight initiative battles under state law. So we didn't think that it would, as a practical matter, set us back. And second, I think we thought that the opportunity to have a trial, to make a record, is something that could help move forward not only a judicial case, but public opinion. Because if you read Judge Walker's decision, it is a decision that teaches. It is a decision that explains. It is a decision that anyone who reads it, I think, will be affected in their views. And I think that, to some extent, just having Ted Olson and myself, we are really quite different ideologically. There are not a lot of things we agree on other than this issue. And I think having the two of us there together, not only is Ted an extremely fine lawyer, and I've got the scars from Bush v. Gore to prove it, but he is somebody who has great respect among the conservative community in this country. And so when the two of us are together fighting this battle, I think it sends a message that this is not a conservative or a liberal issue. It's not a Republican or Democratic issue. It's a civil rights issue. It's a human rights issue. It's a constitutional issue, something that everybody ought to be in favor of. And we thought that having that combination, having the opportunity to make a record, having an opportunity to bring the people who favored discrimination into court and make them testify under oath and cross-examination was something that would help move public opinion. And I think we were right.
Well, several of the questions actually go to that issue of bringing the folks into court, and they ask, I mean, these can sort of be grouped as a what were they thinking questions.
Right.
And they go to why didn't the other side put on a better case? Is it that the case wasn't there? Is it that they were embarrassed about it? Or did the proponents make a kind of tactical error by expressing a contempt for the trial in calling the experts, and the asker of this question puts experts in scare quotations, the right. experts that they called. That is, what do you think the other side was thinking in its decision about whom to call, and at several points to say, reason, I don't need no stinking reason.
Right. Well, at one of the press conferences near the end of the trial, the spokesperson for the other side, who is not the lawyer, but it was the spokesperson for the proponents of Proposition 8, accused me of trying to elevate science over religion. And I suppose, in a sense, that was true if you're talking about judicial decisions in the legislative arena. But I think that they didn't have a case to put on. This was not a case where they had bad lawyers. They had good lawyers. They had able, energetic lawyers that really did the best job they could to put on a case. Sometimes people on the sidelines think that when they lose, the way to explain the loss is to blame the people who were fighting the battle. These lawyers were good lawyers. They worked hard. They presented the case well. The problem is there wasn't a case to present. And it wasn't that they didn't try. They went out and they had 6 or 8 expert witnesses that they had recruited. We then took their depositions. And it turned out that they couldn't sustain under cross-examination the propositions that they had been hired to advance. And in fact, 2 of their witnesses gave us testimony that we liked well enough so that we played their videotapes in our case. And the judge quotes them in his opinion. This was not a situation in which they didn't try. It's not a situation in which they didn't try as hard as they could. It was just a situation in which there wasn't the support for the arguments they had to make. And when you don't have support, you can have the best lawyers in the world. But if you don't have any evidence, you really can't survive in a courtroom.
A couple of the questioners mentioned the role of religion, which you alluded to as well in your opening comments, and sort of suggested that if religion wasn't the explanation, there was no other explanation. Is that some of what you think was going on?
I do. This in Proposition 8 was a proposition that had proponents from a wide spectrum of backgrounds, but it was one in which the engine that drove Proposition 8 was an engine that was financed and organized by certain religions that have strong views about whether or not people who are of the same sex should be able to marry. And as I said, those religions are entirely entitled to those points of view. I believe that's part, again, of the fabric of our culture, which is that we're not going to tell people what to believe as part of their religion. But at the same time, I think part of our culture is that we don't let religions enforce their own moral or religious views on other people. And I think that was what, to some extent, the case was about.
Another questioner asks what your favorite moment was of the trial. And I guess we should take out yesterday.
Yesterday was really the... There were a couple...
What's your runner-up?
There were a couple of favorite moments. One of my favorite moments was right at the end of the trial, and Ted Olson gave the rebuttal argument in June, and it was a 30-minute argument, and it was an argument that, because it was rebuttal, couldn't be thoroughly prepared ahead of time. You could get ready for it, you could learn the facts and the law, you could think a lot about it, but you can't really get ready for a rebuttal argument. And he got up and he gave 30 minutes that was the best oral argument that I've ever heard. And it was just great. And we had an overflow courtroom. And when you're actually in the courtroom with a judge, everybody's got to be very quiet and everything. But in this overflow courtroom, which was like a room like this with a big television screen, because there were too many people who wanted to watch to get into the official courtroom, when they finished, people got up and cheered. And it was just a terrific argument. That was certainly one of my favorite moments. Probably a second one was cross-examining Blankenhorn. Because he started out with all of the conclusory assertions that he gives when he engages in speeches and debates on this issue. And he's one of the leading proponents of prohibiting gay and lesbian marriage. He goes around the country. He's got a foundation that people contribute to. He's an articulate, effective person in some respects in those forms. But as I say, the witness box is a lonely place, and it's hard to hide, and it's hard to sustain assertions that aren't backed up with facts and evidence. And as the cross-examination went on, he admitted more and more of our case. And when he finally admitted that America would be more American the day that we permitted gay and lesbian marriage than the day before, that had to be one of my favorite moments. The third was one that I had mixed feelings about. Because one of the things that we did was we called one of the official proponents of Proposition 8. They had listed the official proponents on their witness list. But we didn't think they were going to call them. And we went first, so we had to call them if we were going to hear them. So we subpoenaed one of them. And what happened after that was interesting. We subpoenaed Dr. Tam, who was one of the official proponents. And the first thing that he did after he got the subpoena is he tried to withdraw as an intervening defendant because he thought that if he withdrew as an intervening defendant, we wouldn't be able to call him as a witness. Judge wouldn't let him do that. So we put him on the witness stand, and we went through the kinds of things that he had said and sponsored during the campaign. And the reason it was one of my favorite moments is because what you saw at the trial was a shift, constantly shifting ground as the proponents tried to find some argument that they could stand on. And those of you who remember the campaign remember that it was protect our children. It was an argument that essentially said we don't want our children to learn that gay and lesbian marriage is okay. And they had these ads about these horrified parents who were supposedly sort of driven to sheer terror by the idea that their child came home from school and had the idea that it was all right for gays and lesbians to be married. And when they got to trial, they tried to distance themselves from that message. And they tried to say, well, the thing that is supporting this is not sort of fear. It is that marriage is supposed to be for procreation. And if you don't have people of the opposite sex, they can't just between the two of them procreate, and so they shouldn't be able to get married. Now, one of the things the judge did entirely on his own is he noted that he'd married, like a month earlier, two people well into their 80s. And he said, I don't actually think that they were planning to have children. Perhaps even more to the point is that the Supreme Court had already faced this issue in the Missouri case that I mentioned. If you can't have physical contact, you can't procreate. And the imprisoned felons in the state of Missouri don't get any contact with anybody, let alone members of the opposite sex. So this was something that simply didn't sustain any support in terms of the law or the facts. And then they were sort of driven to another level, which is to say, well, somehow this is going to undermine the institution of marriage. Somehow people are not, you know, straight people aren't going to want to get married if gay people can get married. Now, they'd never had an explanation as to why that was true, and finally they admitted even that they didn't have any evidence for. But that constantly shifting ground, I think, really demonstrated the lack of support that there was in any area for this kind of proposition. And Dr. Tam was Asian American. And one of the things I asked him is I reminded him of the really shameful history that California has in terms of discrimination against Asian Americans. And there were actually laws less than 100 years ago that prohibited Asian Americans and Caucasians from marrying, and if they did marry, they lost various property rights. And I asked him how he would feel today if the state of California was telling him how and he could get married and to whom he could get married. And he said he wouldn't like it, but he also said it didn't change his mind. And I think that in some senses that too was one of my favorite moments, because it showed the extent to which certain views are beyond reason. And I think that it says why you need to have constitutional protection for minority rights.
I want to turn now to a set of questions that are about yesterday's decision itself. Several of the questioners asked whether you were surprised in any way by the judge's ruling or the like. And I confess I was surprised in the following sense. Having read the transcripts and things like that from the trial, it was clear to me that you had a winning case. What surprised me, I guess, was the breadth of the judge's opinion. That is, that it was such a sweeping victory. And I wonder what might have surprised you about Judge Walker's opinion yesterday.
I'm not sure I was surprised, but I was certainly impressed with the thoroughness and completeness with which he analyzed the evidence. That's not easy to do. The judge has got a couple of clerks to help him or her. We had a team of 30 or 40 lawyers working on this case between Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher and my firm. And he really mastered the record in a way that was awesome if you consider the relative state of our resources. I did think that he would analyze the issues. And I thought as he analyzed the issues, he would follow the law and he'd follow the facts. There were people in the beginning who on both sides, I think, questioned his impartiality. He'd been appointed by President Reagan. He was a conservative. But he was a very good judge. He was a very experienced judge. He was a trial lawyer, a good litigator before he went on the bench, been on the bench for more than two decades. He's the chief judge of the Federal District Court for the Northern District of California. And he has respect for the process and respect for the evidence. And I said to people who questioned whether he would really be somebody who we could count on to decide things for in our favor, even if we made our case, is I said, I think he'll follow the law. He'll follow the law. He'll follow the facts. He will be guided by the record we make. And I believe that throughout the trial. And that belief was vindicated with his opinion.
He has for those of you who haven't read the opinion, he has an extraordinarily detailed set of findings of fact in which he points to the individual places in the record where you can find stuff. He quotes it at length. There are subparts to the findings and the like. And obviously, that's the one piece of his decision that will carry forward into the Court of Appeals and ultimately to the Supreme Court without any additional opportunity. That is, on findings of fact, the district court's findings stand, whereas on conclusions of law, Judges review those de novo. For those of you who don't know Latin, that means they don't give any deference. They just do it anew. And so a number of the questions, as you can imagine, are of the kind, so what have you done for us lately,
yes,
David?
Yes, yes.
These are questions in which people are asking, what's going to happen down the road? Some people asked questions about the stay and the question of when is there actually going to be a kind of reopening of marriage for LGBT people in California? And then some people, and we'll go on from there to talk a little bit about the Ninth Circuit and then about the Supreme Court. But a number of the questions ask about your kind of prognosis for the various stages from here on out. So you might want to kind of identify the stages and give your views on your what you think your odds are during
yeah,
this.
Yeah, the next stage, as you indicate, is where they ask to stay it pending appeal. So they say don't enjoin it until the appellate court has had a chance to act. That gets addressed first to Judge Walker, and Judge Walker has said he will decide that next week. I don't know what he's going to do. In cases like this, judges can go either way. On the other hand, he's held pretty clearly that this is a serious deprivation of constitutional rights, and there is a very strong tendency not to stay judicial opinions that hold those kinds of restrictions unconstitutional. Because what happens is that every day that goes by, people are being deprived of their constitutional rights. So I think there is a good argument not to stay it. If he does not stay it, then they can apply for a stay to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I think the main importance of the stay, other than how quickly people can get beyond Proposition 8, is that I think that the issue of a stay is going to mean that we're going to get a very expedited appeal. If a stay is granted, I think that the court is going to feel that they need to expedite the decision for us. If the stay is denied, I think the court may feel it needs to expedite the decision for the other side. So I'm hopeful that the issue of stay will actually be an engine that will help drive us to an expedited result. Now, typically, when a decision is appealed from a federal district court to the Court of Appeals, it goes to a three-judge panel. And then after those judges have decided it, in unusual cases, you can have what is called an en banc review, which means that all of the active judges, all the active judges in every circuit except the Ninth, then decide it. In the Ninth, it's usually half the active judges because the Ninth Circuit has so many Court of Appeals judges that it's hard for them to all fit into one room comfortably. It's the largest circuit by far in the country. This is a situation in which it's possible that the court would decide to go directly to an en banc hearing. It's important enough so that they might decide, as part of expediting it and getting to a final resolution, that they would go directly en banc and not have a three-judge panel hear it. I've had that happen to me a couple times. The last time it was in the Microsoft case. And when we won that case at trial, the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, which was the Court of Appeals that the appeal went to, bypassed a three-judge panel and heard it initially en banc. So there's precedent to do that. Court might consider doing that. Once it's through in the Ninth Circuit, it will go to the United States Supreme Court. And again, I think that when it gets there depends on how fast it moves through the Ninth Circuit. But I think it is quite conceivable that we could argue in the Ninth Circuit before the end of this year. We could get a decision in the first half of this coming year. and we could be in the United States Supreme Court sometime in 2011.
One of the things that you had said earlier when you were talking about your favorite moments was about your the delight in the overflow room during Ted Olson's rebuttal. Yeah. And that brings us back to something that happened earlier in this case and ties in with your recent comments about the stay. And that is, this case has been to the Supreme Court in a very preliminary phase already, which was Judge Walker wanted to allow closed-circuit televising of the trial. The Ninth Circuit was prepared to allow that. And the proponents of Proposition 8 went to the Supreme Court and got a stay out of the Supreme Court of the televising. Do you think that the stay litigation is likely to go up to the Supreme Court again? And will you have a better sense from the stay litigation of where the Supreme Court is on the primary issue in the case?
I think if the issue of the stay does go to the United States Supreme Court, it's possible that you would get an indication of how the court is leaning. Now, that's not reliable in the sense of being a perfect predictor, but it could give you an illustration because sometimes, and this is unusual, but in some cases, and this is an unusual case, judges actually write opinions in terms of the stay. And so if you get some of the judges on the Supreme Court writing decisions on the stay and their rationale for granting or denying a stay, that could give you an indication of how they're going to go.
A number of the questions ask about whether this case is definitely going to the Supreme Court, and they can be divided into kind of two groups. One group of the questions say, well, if you lose in front of the Court of Appeals, what are the chances that you could persuade the Supreme Court to take the case? And the other group of questions ask exactly the converse, which is there any way that you can keep this case from going to the Supreme Court if you win in the Ninth Circuit?
Yes and no.
In either order.
Yeah. I think it's likely this case is going to the United States Supreme Court. I think it's certain that the case is going to the United States Supreme Court if we win in the Ninth Circuit.
And is that because there are four justices that you already kind of count as being against you enough that they're going to...
No, it's because what has happened here is that a court has held a state law unconstitutional. And I think that a decision that is as broad as Judge Walker's decision is one that I think... because of its potential national effect, the Supreme Court would be reluctant to have go into effect without Supreme Court review. Now, there's one qualification, and that is that you could have a narrow ground for the Ninth Circuit affirming this decision. Judge Walker wrote a very broad opinion that addressed due process and equal protection, found the Proposition 8 violated both of them, and violated them because there was no rational basis for the proposition and for the discrimination against gays and lesbians on the grounds of marriage. That broad opinion would have general applicability throughout the United States if it were followed. It would be possible to affirm, and courts sometimes affirm on very narrow grounds. You may get a broad opinion below and a narrow ground for affirmance. You could affirm this decision based on factors peculiar to California. And if you did... then the Supreme Court might not take it. For example, California's got this crazy quilt right now in which you have 18,000 gay and lesbian couples who were lawfully married between the California Supreme Court decision and Proposition 8. And those marriages are valid. On the other hand, their next-door neighbors can't get married. So you have this conundrum of where you're treating people who are exactly the same. Both groups are gays and lesbians. Both groups want to get married. 18,000 of them are able to get married lawfully, the rest not. Indeed, those that are lawfully married now, if they get divorced, can't get remarried. They can't even remarry themselves. Now, that strikes somebody as not being particularly rational. And you could decide the case on that grounds. Also, California held that gays and lesbians had a right to get married. So Proposition 8 did not merely preserve the status quo. It changed the status quo. It took away a right that people had. And the court might say, the Ninth Circuit might say, that a combination of those circumstances that are unusual to California are what makes Proposition 8 unconstitutional. If the court did that, then maybe the Supreme Court wouldn't take it.
Seems to me there's another complication as well, which you've alluded to in a couple of ways, and that is this is a case where the proponents, the defendants in the case, the people who actually defended Proposition 8 were the ballot proponents. The state itself really did a laydown. The attorney general said he thought the statute was outright unconstitutional. The amendment was outright unconstitutional. And the state refused to mount any defense, and indeed in their answers to requests for admission that you all filed, they agreed with you on every central point. What bearing does that have on the future of the case?
Well, there is an interesting legal question. There is real doubt as to whether non-official defendants, that is, people who are not the state, have a right to appeal. They have a right to intervene at the trial court level and have their views considered. But there is jurisprudence, including from the United States Supreme Court, indicating that they don't have the standing under Article 3 of the Constitution to actually pursue an appeal. So it is conceivable that since the state is unlikely to appeal, since, as you say, they have taken positions that are really inconsistent with appealing, and if the ballot proponents didn't have standing to appeal, then you would have a very unusual circumstance. It is one that I think the court is going to have to grapple with, because it is a serious argument that they don't have standing to appeal. And it'll be interesting to see how that all comes out.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is noted attorney David Boies, chairman of the law firm of Boies, Schiller & Flexner, LLP, and winner yesterday of a major victory in the Northern District of California in the Perry litigation, which held that the due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment are violated by California's restriction of marriage to opposite-sex couples. We're now reaching the end of the program, and we have time for one more question, and so I'm going to group yet another group of questions together. And these are, nobody is asking you, what do you think Justice Scalia is going to do in this case? Because if California can't appeal, he will come out here personally himself and lay down on the tracks to prevent any gay couples from getting married. But a number of the people have asked about three of the justices in particular. Many people have noted Justice Kennedy and his pivotal role on the court. Two questioners asked about Chief Justice Roberts and his institutional role. And one person asked, since Elena Kagan has been confirmed today, what's she going to do? So We'll end with your sort of speculations on what the Supreme Court might do and how you go about counting the tea leaves.
Well, first of all, I should say that Ted and I have a deal. His responsibility is to get the five justices who voted for him on Bush v. Gore. My job is to get the four justices that voted for me. We will then have all nine. It'll be unanimous. On a more serious note, we are not taking any justice for granted on this issue. And we're not giving up on any justice. This is a complicated issue. It's an issue on which people have had conflicting views over the years. It is an issue in which I would hope and I expect that the court, when it gets this case, is going to look at the evidence that we made in this record. We've made a record that's never been made before in court. We have findings of fact, and as you said at the beginning, every court, as you get up, go up, has an entirely free shot at what the law is. They don't have to give any deference at all to what a so-called lower court has thought about the law. But the findings of fact stand unless they can be demonstrated to be clearly erroneous. And I would hope that every justice on the court would look at this record and look at these findings and follow the law as it applies to these findings of fact. And if they do that, I think we ought to win every one of those justices. Now, I'm not saying we're going to, but I'm saying we're not giving up on anybody. This is a situation in which we have seen in the past, as you move towards greater equality, people have to abandon decisions that they made before. People have to abandon positions. And I'm very conscious of the fact that we're going to be arguing this to judges that are of my generation. My generation is a generation that grew up with not only discrimination against gays and lesbians, but violence, attacks, all sorts of... when President Eisenhower, along with most of the justices on the in the courts, when I was in high school, they were in high school, President Eisenhower issued an executive order that said no gay or lesbian could be employed by the federal government in any capacity, not as a mail carrier, not as a clerk typist, in any capacity. You had laws prohibiting gays and lesbians from various employments, not merely allowing employers to discriminate, but forcing employers to discriminate. That was the culture in which those of us of a certain age grew up. And what you have to do is you have to ask judges to put those cultural influences aside. That's hard to do, but judges are taught to do that. And the best judges do that. And so I'm hopeful that when we get to the court with the findings that we have now, and I think with the greater recognition that we have over even a decade ago of the need and deserving nature of equality in this country, I would hope that every one of the nine justices would listen to these arguments.
Our thanks to David Boies, chairman of the law firm of Boies, Schiller & Flexner LLP, for his comments this evening. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's U.S. Constitution in the 21st Century series, underwritten by the Charles Geschke family. I'm Professor Pam Carlin, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.